The following Muriel Falzer Bodek Public Affairs Lecture features Dr. Kathleen Hall Jamieson, Elizabeth Ware Packard Professor of Communication, and Walter Lenore Annenberg, Director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center. It was recorded live at the University of Pennsylvania's Van Pelt Dietrich Library Center on Friday, May 11, 2007.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Van Pelt Dietrich Library Center for this year's Muriel Falzer Bodek Public Affairs Lecture. My name's Carton Rogers. I'm the Vice Provost and Director of Libraries here at Penn, and I'm delighted that you were able to join us this afternoon. Before we hear from today's speaker, I would like to extend a special welcome to our alumni who have joined us for this Alumni Weekend event. It's a pleasure to have you back on the campus and, more importantly, in the library. I'd also like to recognize the generosity of the Bodek family. Their support of this lecture series, the library's physical improvement, and the larger university has made Penn a better place for students and faculty, thanks to a wonderful Penn family. For those of you who haven't been with us before, this is an annual event, and it is, as I say, sponsored by the Bodek family in memory of Muriel Falzer Bodek. This year's distinguished speaker is Dr. Kathleen Hall Jamieson, and she will speak with us in a minute about her recent work with Brooks Jackson entitled Unspun, Finding Facts in a World of Disinformation. Copies of the book will be available after the lecture in the back of the room. And before I forget and get yelled at by my development people, if you wouldn't mind, would you sign the guest book at the back of the room before you leave? We'd appreciate it. Unspun is a particularly important and timely work because of the information-rich environment we all find ourselves in. As we go about our daily lives, we are bombarded with information, and more problematically, disinformation. To be useful citizens, wise consumers, intelligent voters, we've got to hone our information assessment skills. We see the same issues here in the library. Students and faculty are confronted with a deluge of information resources that number literally in the millions. Some are vetted and some are not. We organize and provide access to millions of dollars worth of licensed digital resources for the Penn community. But Google remains the search tool of choice for most of our users. And as you know, a Google search usually returns many, many hits, most of dubious quality and of utility. Even Google admits that very few of their users are curious enough to drill down past the first page or two of results to find out if what appears on the third, fourth, or tenth page might be more useful to them in their quest for information. So how do you assess the results? In the library world, we refer to this issue as information literacy, and it is something we spend a lot of time on with our users. Perhaps it would be easier if we just bought thousands of copies of this book and handed them out to every freshman as they enter Penn. Quoting from the back of the book, Unspun provides us with the warning signs of spin, hype, and bogus news. It exposes the common tricks used to deceive us and gives us tools to find trustworthy and objective sources of information. As the political analyst Mark Shields writes, this book is the ultimate BS detector. Our speaker is the Elizabeth Ware Packard Professor of Communication and Walter and Lenore Annenberg Director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center, an expert on political campaigns and frequent commentator on PBS. Dr. Jamieson has co-authored or edited 17 books. Her studies include political communication, rhetorical theory, theory and criticism, forms of campaign communication, and the discourse of the presidency. Dr. Jamieson has received numerous teaching and service awards, including the Christian R. and Mary F. Lindback Award. She has also been the recipient of fellowships and grants, including support from the Pew Charitable Trusts, the Ford Foundation, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, and the Carnegie Corporation of New York. She is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and a member of the American Philosophical Society. Now, she probably doesn't remember this, but when she was the dean of the Annenberg School a few years ago, the library was going through one of our periodic bouts with runaway inflation in the cost of information. And we came to the Council of Deans to plead for a mid-year surge in funding so that we could keep the wolves from the door. We made our case, and Dean Jameson immediately said, absolutely, we need to do this, in spite of the fact that it was going to take a chunk out of her budget and the budgets of her fellow deans. I remember being very impressed at how decisive and supportive she was. I'm also glad that on that occasion, her BS detector didn't go off. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Kathleen Hall Jameson.
Thank you. I'd like to join in thanking the Bodick family for not only making it possible to have lectures such as these, but for their support of the university. It's always a pleasure on Alumni Weekend to look at your schedule during the day and realize that former students from as far back as you've been at an institution are coming back to say hi. It's been just a pleasure this part of the semester to mark getting one's grades in and seeing all those old friends who were the beneficiaries, we hope, of that education and those grades in the past. The book Unspun is actually a book that I started writing a long time ago, but I didn't know that I was writing it at the time. And my colleagues who have asked, did you feel the need to write this book out of being a dean at the Annenberg School and confronting all of the rhetoric that deans confront? I said, no, actually, it was my contact with the political world that led to this book. And very early in the time when I began to study political advertising, I realized that we were seeing a change in the discourse norms surrounding advertising. And for most of my life, that's been a focus of mine. Very early in the history of advertising, when something that was deceptive on television in the 1950s and early 60s was aired, and someone pointed it out, and the someone could be the other side, the other campaign, it could be a journalist, it was occasionally both, the ad was changed. There was the assumption that if it was pointed out, and whether it had been there deliberately or not, different question, but if it was pointed out, there would be a penalty for continuing to air it. And you would take a hit, you, the candidate, personally. You might lose votes because you had engaged, whether deliberately or not, in that deception. I began writing something beyond history, but an analysis of the accuracy of discourse with a book that was published in the 1990s but was written in 1988. The writing was begun in 1988 over that campaign. In that campaign, when inaccuracies aired on either side, first, they were very unlikely to be pointed out. Because journalism had changed. Journalism didn't see its role as being the arbiter of what was accurate or not in politics. Journalism had conventionalized a form of politics that we shorthand by calling it horse race coverage, that essentially said, he says this, she says that, or he says, she says, she says. And the journalist doesn't then step in to say, and here's the context for understanding it, here's the factual underpinning of the claims, here's what might be problematic. The journalist just lets it stand. Well, if the journalist believes the journalist's role is transcribing the opposing points of view and not being the custodian of fact, then if there were a check in the system, that check has been taken out. And we began, as we were studying the press in the 80s, culminating in the 88 campaign, to realize that journalists no longer conceived their role as being custodians of fact. We realized as well that opposing campaigns were now more likely, when they aired something that could be misunderstood, saying it's deceptive assumes it was intentional, let's just say it could be misunderstood, were far less likely, when it was pointed out, to do anything except hunker down and defend. There didn't seem to be a belief that there was any penalty out there anymore. And so we did what scholars of communication do. We started trying to quantify the phenomenon, and we found that when something that was deceptive was pointed out by someone, the opposing campaign or the press, and less likely to be the press, the ad volume that was aired behind the claim was now more likely to increase than it had in the past, and we detected the assumption driving the decision. The assumption, of course, was one correction in news, not really read or heard by a lot of people, and even if they'd heard it, perhaps could be overridden by a lot of airings of the deceptive claim. And as a result, we became concerned that inaccuracies might reach voters who might vote differently because they believed something that they might not believe if they'd had the full story. And even if they would have voted the same way, that they might misforecast governance from the campaign because they had inaccurate information in place. And so, out of research on other things, I began to think about and try to write about what the discourse norms ought to be for analyzing deception in politics. And I titled the book, Dirty Politics, Deception, Distraction, and Democracy. Now, at the same time that this is happening, in universities, largely in English departments, but in other departments as well, there were scholars who were beginning to question whether or not there was such a thing as fact, whether everything is really just someone's point of view writ large, and whether our beliefs don't in fact shape and decisively determine what we will grant as fact. One can make a persuasive case that we in fact do select some things to feature over others based on what we already believe. Psychologists have told us that for a long time. One can also argue that the very language that we speak in carries assumptions into it that shape how audiences perceive it, indeed may exclude all sorts of possibilities, and we're not even aware of it. As the literary critic Kenneth Burke said, language does our thinking for us. But underlying the academic discussion was an assumption that perhaps there wasn't anything that could be called fact out there, and that tradition, raising important intellectual questions, was calling into question a notion that to that point I had presupposed as a scholar, because I came from a different tradition. It was important to see that set of insights and see them play out and to ask, well, what does that mean for politics? What it ultimately could mean is that spin isn't really something that you should worry about, because it's inevitable. We're all going to do it. There isn't any neutral ground that you can go to adjudicate fact, and as a result, it's a futile enterprise. I stopped talking about fact at that point, influenced by this discussion, and started talking about consensual fact. Now, that's not artful as a concept, but underlying it was the notion that of course, we don't actually know how many people are unemployed. We don't. We have a method for ascertaining it. The method has limitations. The definition is never going to be as exact in capturing the thing, if you could even say the thing existed. And that, as a result, what you're talking about when you say the unemployed is a consensually granted piece of evidence, constructed in a particular way with a particular methodology with particular definitions, but nonetheless something we should be able to grant for purposes of discussion in politics. And so if some of my colleagues were saying no fact, I could say to them, at some level I agree, but we have to have some place to ground our observations of what it is we're dealing with and whether we're going to define them as problems or not. And to get there, we are going to have what the academic community ultimately generates as standards of adjudication that have methodological sophistication under them and arrive at a consensual observation that we will grant. Now, we're in the early 1990s at this point, and I am comfortable because I've got my notion of consensual fact. And I know that nothing is, well, nothing, that most things aren't ever going to be, you know, particularly exact, but that there are things we're going to be able to work with in politics. Enter another phenomenon in politics. We're observing political discourse during this time, and we're coming to see that the things that I was naively calling consensual facts weren't consensual anymore. That is, the political candidates and their teams had discovered that they could take just about anything that was once granted by everyone and make it problematic enough that they could make engagement on the topic virtually impossible. Spin and politics had now become synonyms. And once that occurs, one has real difficulty if one is a journalist, because one can't go to that formerly neutral ground that everybody would grant and say, this side says this, this side says that, but the Bureau of Labor Statistics says X. I am, of course, still in a world that wants to believe that when the Bureau of Labor Statistics says X, whether the economists and labor statisticians are disagreeing in the background, we still have a pretty good measure that's getting at an important phenomenon that we have to define and work from, not contest. I started appearing on television, started writing in books, claims that were essentially trying to put in place the notion of consensual fact, but in the English language. Began to start talking with journalists about whether they would start checking those claims, and journalists said two things. First, they said, if there's a deception on one side, it's not my job to point out the deception. So not my role. It's the other side's responsibility. The problem with this, of course, is if you have he said, she said journalism, when the other side points it out, the press account goes like this. He said this, the other side denied it, and now the poor reader doesn't know where to go to know whether one side is accurate, both sides are accurate but somehow confused, or whether they're both just making something up. But journalists' first response was to say, not my job. The custodian of fact role essentially had been given away, but given away to no one, because the only other institution that's standing there is the Academy, and it isn't very comfortable entering into politics with its own expertise to adjudicate these facts. Even though you could walk across this campus and take any claim in politics, any claim, and find an expert who could stand in front of an audience with some education, the audience with some education, and explain a context and a definition and increase the likelihood that there would be understanding about which you could make informed judgments. But the economists weren't particularly comfortable coming in to talk about facts in advertising, and they weren't in the right Rolodex anyway. Nor were the sociologists about sociological phenomena, et cetera. Moreover, the reporters weren't going to them. And so if the reporters had gone to them, maybe they could have elicited that as a response. I started trying to traffic, and I'm using the word traffic deliberately, the consensual understandings of my colleagues in these other fields back into our understanding of claims in politics. An attempt to see if we could get back to grounding some of these things someplace. Ultimately, that led to factcheck.org. How many of you know what factcheck.org is? Those of you who don't, please do me a favor. When you get home, just put in factcheck.org, and if it pops up and says something that you approve of or you'd like to see more of, become a subscriber. We have over 70,000 subscribers. Factcheck.org occurred because Brooks Jackson, who was working for CNN, was laid off at CNN, came to me trying to see if he could partner with something that he wanted to do with some colleges in Maryland. And I asked him instead, since he had been doing fact-checking for CNN, among few journalists doing it, whether he would like to see if we could, at the Annenberg Public Policy Center, use what we can gather from university communities and from organizations of integrity that generate consensual factual data, use that to arbitrate competing claims in politics. Brooks, as you probably know, is a distinguished journalist, Wall Street Journal, AP, CNN, and very, very good at writing the English language. That's important if you're going to translate complex academic data back out to the public and to the press, and factcheck.org was born. How many of you watched the vice presidential debate in 2004? Did you hear the University of Pennsylvania mentioned? Well, if you did, it wasn't because we have great PR. It was because we'd been fact-checking the campaign. And we had fact-checked an ad that attacked Dick Cheney. It attacked Vice President Cheney about his dealings with Halliburton. And it had mistakenly said some things about him profiting from the Halliburton contracts in Iraq. We had gotten the documents, posted the primary sources, created the hyperlinks, and done the fact-check. In an exchange with the Democratic nominee for vice president, now also running for president, Edwards. Edwards attacks. Cheney doesn't have enough time to respond to the attacks. And Cheney says, essentially, go to factcheck.com, where you will find that I'm right. There were two problems. First, the Democratic nominee for vice president was attacking on wholly new grounds. The Democrats had read the fact check, too, and they weren't going to walk into a fact check trap. in which the rebuttal would say, University of Pennsylvania Annenberg Public Policy Center already looked at that, and you're wrong. So brand new set of attacks, unfact-checked by us. Second problem, our name isn't factcheck.com. When people went to their computers and typed in factcheck.com, our nice little website, designed for journalists, never intended for a mass public, was overwhelmed. But it was overwhelmed because when people typed in factcheck.com, they got a little library site that we had tried to buy. It was owned by a 9-year-old girl, and she wouldn't sell it to us. If it had been owned by Russian pornographers, we would have changed our name. But it was owned by a little girl. Well, she sold it to a little library group of some sort, and the little library group had a sense of humor and an ideology. So as all of those people checking to factcheck.com hit their site, they relayed them off their site to George Soros' site. Anybody want to tell me who George Soros wanted to see elected president? Well, it wasn't re-elected president, George Bush. He wanted to elect a new president, John Kerry. And so these poor, bewildered people who had typed in factcheck.com, as the vice president had told them to do, and identified it with the University of Pennsylvania, we were pleased to see, relayed through this, now get to George Soros, and were justifiably confused, but a certain percent persisted, and they crashed our site every 15 minutes for the next 8 hours. Meantime, in the middle of the night, I got a call from our computer staff, which said, we have to buy more server capacity, or we'll never get back up. I didn't even know you could buy server capacity in the middle of the night, but the computer staff did. And by morning, we were up with much more server capacity, and our fact check of the vice president's claim opened with the notion that he was wrong about a number of things. One of them was our name. That led to articles across the country in magazines, because people think this is pretty funny, in which factcheck.org is brought to the attention of a large national audience, and our subscribership soared. We want to publicly thank the vice president. We are not grateful to the Soros website or the website that relayed to them, but we are grateful to people that ultimately found us, and a good percent of them actually stayed. What was FactCheck supposed to do? The reason I tell you this story is first because Penn got good publicity or bad publicity, depending on how you interpret the story. But to say to you that that wasn't the way we wanted the system to work. Our hope was that we would use the classic academic model. And if you go to factcheck.org, I hope you see it there. We take the claim. We tell you how we think it is meant. So if you think it means something else, that's fine, too. But we tell you what we think this means. We think what a reasonable person will say in response to this is the construction that it offers. We then try to adjudicate the claim using consensual sources, and where possible, we hyperlink to those sources so that you can go and check to see whether or not you think we've read them correctly. It's the academic system of footnoting. And if after you've read our fact check and checked our sources, you think we're wrong and you write us, and we think you've made a legitimate point, we will post your response to us. So what we're trying to do is to create a broad context of understanding around these exchanges. What we were not trying to do was have someone use us as an authority and the final word. So Edwards makes a series of claims we had not fact-checked. Cheney says, that's wrong. Factcheck.org, factcheck.com, says that's wrong. Is exactly the model we were worried about. Claims we hadn't checked, statement that's incorrect, and vote, you know, viewers say, well, factcheck.com at the University of Pennsylvania said it was wrong. It must be wrong. Now, they haven't looked at the context. They haven't looked at the definitions. They haven't looked at the sources. So as I was getting congratulatory calls from all of my friends on this PR coup, I was saying to them, that's a malfunction. That's exactly what we were trying not to do. Let me tell you another thing we were trying not to do. We were trying not to appear on television with a journalist saying, here's the ad, here's the claim, Dr. Jameson, is that true or false? False. Instead of ending inquiry, we were trying to open inquiry. We were trying to broaden understandings of the context in which the information existed originally and were being placed. And so we actually managed to try a model and elicit kinds of responses that we had been trying to get rid of. If I had a video machine, I would show you embarrassing clips of me on television having said to the reporter, here's the context for understanding, here's the evidence for, I'm saying, and that's false. Reporter, claim, Jameson, that's false. Jameson is now contributing to the problem. Journalism was doing fact-checking, so how could I be offended? How could I be hurt? Well, they were doing a kind of fact-checking that wasn't increasing critical inquiry, it wasn't increasing critical understanding, it was asking people to trust an authority, and now, worst-case scenario, I was becoming that authority. We wrote this book on the assumption that there are underlying strategies that can be used to determine when something is factually problematic. They're not infallible, but some cues that tell you when something is more likely to be factually problematic, and this is factually as I define it, not an absolute statement of certainty. And also, that once you know where those places are likely to be, you won't need factcheck.org. That you'll be able, following some principles that we've been teaching in universities for at least 300 years, largely in English departments. Yes, that's something bad about English departments. This is something good about English departments. We've been largely teaching how to use evidence in English departments for more than 300 years. But that you can draw on those standards and tests and get away from the notion that an authority draws any conclusion. If you want to come someplace to find out how we drew our conclusion, we will still be there. That's really what the book is about. Let me give you a couple of quick examples of what those principles are. And this book was not written for college graduates or graduates of the University of Pennsylvania. It was really written for people who don't have the kind of analytic skills that are developed in a university education, are developed in good high school courses in English. Let me give you an example of a principle that will tell you, in my judgment, when you should be a little more vigilant. If you see an ad and it's scary, be wary. If it's scary, be wary. Now, it's not always true that scary ads are problematic. In fact, there's some things we should be genuinely terrified about, and we should be genuinely terrified about them, and the claims are absolutely accurate. But in general, when you see wolves prowling around on a screen, and they're scary, and the intercuts show you a forest in half light, and now the wolves are scarier. And in case you didn't pick up that they were scary, the music is scary. So scary music and scary wolves and scary intercuts. And now somebody says that John Kerry voted against intelligence or voted for intelligence cuts after the first terrorist attack. Be wary. Because that's literally true, but probably inferentially false if you hear by that after September 11th. Now, maybe you didn't hear it that way. That would be good. But the Annenberg Public Policy Center runs the National Annenberg Election Survey, which is the largest survey done by an academic institution of the electorate. And we know that over half the electorate believed that it was true that John Kerry voted for intelligence cuts after September 11th. Another test. If you think about it and it seems really implausible, it probably is. Let's think about September 11th. The towers have come down. Pennsylvania is frightened. Philadelphia is frightened. We don't know whether we're going to be next. We have loved ones in New York. The country is terrified. You think that anybody, even the person with the least common sense you've ever known, would then say, you know, I'm going to go and vote against intelligence. I'm going to vote for intelligence cuts. No. But you see, you've never gone to the place that you could have tested plausibility because you didn't actually go through a process of analytically accepting the claim You were being scared and the claims slid through, and by the way, ads and everything else have made Kerry look weak, and maybe ideologically you're disposed to believe that about Democrats anyway, and now those things come together and you've got a surprising percent of the electorate thinking something that wouldn't make a lot of sense if we tested it through plausibility, but they were scared. We were scared. Now, you notice that they were scared? Well, here's another principle. We think they are vulnerable to deception, but we don't think we are. As social psychologists have known for a long time, particularly since Kahneman and Tversky, experts make all the same mistakes that non-experts make. We have the same cognitive mechanism, and as a result, we're disposed to make mistakes too. One danger is that we're perfectly confident that we're invulnerable, and as a result, we are vulnerable. Let me give you another principle. I articulated it earlier. Language does our thinking for us. Now, I offered it in the context of a whole scholarly debate about whether there was fact or not, but there's a broader truth underlying the notion that language does our thinking for us, and it certainly does when you're dealing with political advertising and politics. We know, for example, that when you say intact, dilation, and extraction, intact, dilation, and extraction, it sounds like it's a medical procedure. It sounds like doctor talk. It sounds like something that experts in that area ought to make decisions about. You wouldn't ordinarily make decisions about intact, dilation, and extraction. It's expert language. But call it partial birth abortion, and you're now in a trajectory in which you are far more likely to take one ideological position than another. Now, it doesn't mean that one is spinning and the other isn't. Language is inevitably creating our sense of reality, and we're inevitably thinking through it. But rather that when we're unaware that we've embraced language, we sometimes can get places we wouldn't go if we questioned the language. Let me offer you an example that we, again, have survey data on. There was an ad produced by MoveOn.org. Now, we took on Bush with the Wolves ad, so now we're going to take on the Democrats with MoveOn.org. I asked my students, by the way, and I know some of you are here, at the end of semesters, can you tell what my ideology is? And if they can, at the end of the semester, I view myself as a failed professor. Because they're Penn students, they often ask, so what is it? And I tell them I'm a vegetarian anarchist. There was an ad that was put together by MoveOn.org, and it showed a gun, an automatic weapon. And in the background of the ad, you heard, that's not exactly what an automatic weapon sounds like, but you can fill in automatic weapon. It was rapid firing. And it suggested that horrible things were going to happen because the assault weapons ban had not been renewed. Do you remember the debate? I have very intelligent, very well-educated friends who saw that ad and believed that the gun that was shown was going to come back on the streets as a result of the end of the assault weapons ban. Why would they think that? Well, what's an assault weapons ban doing? It must be banning assault weapons. And once you grant that an assault weapons ban bans assault weapons rather than some narrow type of weapons with some particular features, and I'm not making an argument for or against the assault weapons ban, but it didn't ban all assault weapons. You're first likely to assume that more things were banned than were actually banned, but secondly, you're not likely to say, do you think maybe we banned that weapon about the time of Al Capone? Because, of course, the assault weapons ban wouldn't have taken out the previous legislation. It would have built on top of it. So when you take the assault weapons ban so-called out, the previous legislation stays. And the weapon that was being shown on the screen was already banned when the assault weapons ban came in, and as a result was unaffected by it. Now, I can make a plausible case for the assault weapons ban so-called, even though it didn't ban as many things as some people would have liked. But it's very difficult when people have assumed that it did a lot of things it didn't do to tell them that ad is frightening you in ways you don't need to be frightened. Maybe you should still be frightened about all this, but not based on that. Language tends to do our thinking for us. And we know that people overgeneralize the scope of the assault weapons ban. What politics has tended to do from the beginning of politics is find labels that we're willing to embrace and attach them to things that they may not be legitimately attached to. Now notice, up to this point, I think I can find something that even a radical deconstructionist would grant has some basis out there in what might be called fact. I can look at the voting record to see where and when and on what John Kerry voted. I can look at the legislation to see, is that gun in or is it out? Was it covered or wasn't it? I'm able, as a result, to go someplace that potentially helps you if you or I know where to go. If it's scary, be wary. Be a little vigilant. Let's look further. Language does our thinking for us. Awfully appealing label. What's actually under it? Test of plausibility. NRA ad says Kerry wants to ban hunting rifles. Kerry wants to ban hunting rifles. Really? Does that seem plausible to you? Think of everything you know about the person who is most liberal on gun control. They really want to stop you from hunting. Well, you might be ideologically disposed to think that that's a tendency there, but is it really plausible? Often if you can get to the test of plausibility, you question the ad. You ask what actually was in the legislation. So the book offers you a series of rules, and those are among the rules. The book also raises some questions about what we hear when we hear claims about certainty. Weapons of mass destruction. What's the first problem with weapons of mass destruction, apart from the fact that we didn't find them? What does it mean to say weapon of mass destruction? When the language moved in, language does our thinking for us. When language, that language moves into the press, we've now got a category in which we all talk and we're now thinking. It's called weapons of mass destruction. What does it mean? Does it mean chemical weapons? And if so, what do we mean by chemical weapons? Does it mean biological weapons? And if so, what do we mean by biological weapons? Is it hiding nuclear weapons under it? And what do we mean by nuclear weapons? We didn't really have that debate before the press and the public bought the language. We also didn't have the debate about what mass in mass destruction means. Does mass destruction mean that it kills a few people? Maybe five. Does it mean it kills more people? 28. Does it mean it wipes out New York City? What does it mean? I would suggest, based on no evidence whatsoever, but an intuition, that if we'd stopped the debate the first time weapons of mass destruction was offered us as vocabulary, and just said, could we stop for a minute to ask what you mean, and then what you know in relationship to that, that we might have had a different kind of debate. It might have had the same outcome, but we might have had a different kind of debate. What was the standard of proof by which the claims about weapons of mass destruction was accepted? How many of you watched 60 Minutes when George Tenet was interviewed? Okay. How many of you have read his book? Okay. 60 Minutes. I brought my transcript. Interviewer. I'm sorry, Mr. Tenet. We believed he had chemical and biological weapons. No, no. Actually, before that, interviewer says, how could you make such a bold statement? The bold statement is, Tenet's team was about to make an historic blunder, this is the interviewer, of its own. The CIA produced its evaluation of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction in a secret report called a National Intelligence Estimate. The key first judgment in the National Intelligence Estimate says, quote, Baghdad has chemical and biological weapons, period. Interviewer. I'm sorry, Tenet. High confidence judgment. Okay? High Tenet. High confidence judgment. Interviewer. How could you make such a bold statement? Tenet. We believed he had chemical and biological weapons. No, no. Interviewer. But there was no hard evidence. Tenet. No, no. There was lots of data. There's lots of technical data. So you put all of this together and evidence. It's not evidence in the court of law. Remember, when you write an estimate, you estimate. You're writing what you don't know. You might win a civil case, huh? You're not going to win a criminal case in terms of evidence. Interviewer, we are going to war. Tens of thousands of people are going to be killed. Tenant, yeah. Interviewer, and you're telling me you had evidence to prove a civil case and not a criminal case. Tenant, well, hindsight is perfect. The public face on this was what we wrote on the weapons of mass destruction, and for professionals who pride themselves on being right, this is a very painful experience for us. Question for listener. Why didn't we ask what your standard of proof was? Tenet is hearing, I can prove a civil case. I can't prove a criminal case when I made this claim about biological and chemical weapons. I need the help of a lawyer. May I have a volunteer lawyer? Sir, could you tell me the difference?
A civil case needs only a majority or a disposition toward it being true, where a criminal case requires beyond a reasonable doubt. So you only need 50.9999999 or 0001 to win a civil case, but you need 99.0001. It's sort of like that.
Okay, preponderance of evidence versus beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, we've got experience with this. Remember, we're trying to get a concept out to a public that doesn't have necessarily college, university education. But we have experience with this. Remember O.J. Simpson? In the criminal case, what's the ruling? Test is beyond a reasonable doubt and not guilty. In the civil case, test is preponderance of evidence. What's the ruling? Guilty. Now, what standard did you think they were offering you when they said, we know he has chemical and biological weapons, we know he has weapons of mass destruction? Did you hear beyond a reasonable doubt? Or did you hear preponderance of evidence? He's saying, well, we meant preponderance of evidence.
You didn't say it.
We're hearing, I think, something higher. But this isn't an isolated incident. The students always tease me because I actually do lecture like this. We bring in things from the past week and it shows up in the lecture, and at least they can't say I lecture from yellow sheets of notepaper. This is from Friday, May 11th, 2007, New York Times. That's this morning. This is a headline that says, in support of sex attacker's insanity plea, a look at his brain. Okay? I'm quoting directly now from the New York Times. Under cross-examination, a prosecutor, I won't name him, asked a doctor, I won't name him or her, whether this person's PET scan indicated that he was completely unable to plan on October 31st, 2005, the day he attacked a former editor at W Magazine who had worked in the same newsroom with him. The doctor replied that using 51% as the standard of certainty, the answer to your question is yes. The lawyer says, completely certain? The doctor says, it is statistically associated, but not 100% certain. It's important to ask, when people make claims about what they know, how confident are you? What is the standard that you are applying in making the inference? And it's important that as a country we ask, what is the standard of proof you want to use? What our government should use, we want our government to use, before it takes us into war. The book talks about decisions that don't really require a high level of proof because they're really inconsequential. It probably doesn't make a huge amount of difference whether you eat Rice Krispies or Cheerios. Doing a whole lot of research and becoming very certain that one is nutritionally better than the other or that you shouldn't eat either, for this one breakfast, shouldn't have a high standard of proof because you probably don't have the time unless you're researching obesity and child's addiction to sugar and all of those other things. But let's say you're buying a house or you're buying a car or you're choosing whether or not you should have chemotherapy after a cancer diagnosis. On the big decisions, wouldn't you reasonably expect a much, much tougher standard? I think part of what happened with Iraq was that we didn't ask the right questions about the language that did our thinking for us, weapons of mass destruction. But part of the problem was we didn't ask how certain is your certainty about your statements about what it is you know. I said this to a colleague of mine after seeing the Tenet interview, and he said, of course, Kathleen, they were only dealing with a preponderance of evidence. What on earth made you think beyond a reasonable doubt? Because going to war should require a high standard, in my judgment. One of the things the book asks is, how do you determine what you need to know to make the decision and how much effort you should put into it? I think, had that question been asked, we might have had a different kind of discussion. We might have still gone into this war. The book also tries to talk about all the things that come into play, and this is drawing on the literature developed by our colleagues in social psychology, that make it really hard for us to do the sorts of things the book encourages one to do. And we've adopted a notion by Professor Barron, who's in our psychology department, of active open-mindedness as an ideal, counter-arguing against your own positions, trying deliberately to expose to the other side, to try to be aware of where you might be selecting evidence to conform to your beliefs rather than questioning the evidence. We talk in the book, for example, about the evidence from social psychology, which says that all of us, maybe not you specifically, most of us, maybe not me specifically, most of us, apply a different test of evidence to those things we disagree with than to those things we agree with. So give me a fact that comports with my ideology, even if it's a sloppy fact, an inexact fact, an unfact, and I'm not going to question it. It agrees with my ideology. I'm going to grab it. Give me a fact that disagrees with me, and I will apply the highest possible test of evidence because I want to get rid of it. Different standards of evidence depending on whether we want to embrace it or not. The question then becomes, how do you write that balance? And what do you do to minimize the likelihood that you're deceived as a result? Another possibility. People we know from social psychology seek out evidence to confirm what they already believe. They don't just stand as neutral agents waiting for the stuff to come in and accept the stuff that they agree with and reject the stuff they don't. They actively seek out. They seek to confirm with supportive evidence what they already believe. We know that people create stories to be coherent. There's a natural tendency to make your stories coherent. Let me backtrack to a book that I wrote a long time ago. How many of you know about Willie Horton? Every time I say, Willie Horton, I'm waiting for the student class to raise its hand and say, I wasn't born yet, I don't know. That has become such a strong identified moment in political history that we've actually transmitted it down to generations that weren't around when that ad first aired. I'm not going to tell you the story of Willie Horton and why that ad was deceptive and that his name was really William or any of those kinds of things. I want to tell you something else. George Herbert Walker Bush, President Bush Sr., Bush 41, in a speech talks about Horton, who jumped furlough in Massachusetts, who raped a woman and assaulted her fiancé. Those are facts. As best one can ascertain with consensual evidence. Said he then murdered again. Now, why did George Herbert Walker Bush in that speech say that Horton murdered again? He didn't. We could say, well, let's hypothesize that I love George Herbert Walker Bush. He made an innocent mistake. Let's assume that I really don't like him at all. Well, he just made it up. He's deceptive. Let me give you a third alternative. The story is more coherent if he murdered again. And we tend to make stories more coherent. We round off rough edges. We insert things that didn't even happen. A murderer is on furlough and murders again because a liberal governor who opposes capital punishment hadn't abolished the furlough program is a more coherent story than he rapes and assaults. Now, it's still awful that he rapes and assaults, but the story is more coherent. Okay, I know what you're saying. Well, that was George Herbert Walker Bush. The New York Times said the same thing. Now, New York Times wasn't a big fan of George Herbert Walker Bush. The New York Times picks up an AP story, but there's an editor sitting there at the New York Times. They just don't clip and post, I hope. And if they did, well, then the AP got it wrong. And that story says that Horton murdered again. Why? Because we tend to create coherence that makes sense in narrative fashion. If you doubt this, find one of your siblings and ask about some major event in your childhood past that they shared. I bet the stories don't come back to be the same story, and I bet that your story and your sibling's story are completely coherent. We tend to forget the parts that embarrassed us. We tend to forget the things that we did wrong. We tend to forget the moments that we initiated things that were problematic. We tend to round off things in ways that make us look better. We also tend to round out things in ways that make them more coherent. If we're aware of the tendency, we can ask, is that story too good to be true? What's the likelihood that Jessica Lynch went down to the last bullet, fought every single round, and then got out her knife and was trying to knife the enemy before she was taken captive? What's the likelihood? Well, we certainly would like to believe it. We're in a war. And whether you support the war or not, you want to believe that you've got heroic individuals out there defending their country. An attractive young woman who goes into the military because she wants to serve her country and get a college education. And it makes you feel good to have a story in which all those pieces come together. It's a good narrative. At the end of that narrative, you feel good about your country, even if you don't favor the war. You feel good about her. You got a hero. It's not a great story to say her gun jammed. In fact, it's a different story. She comes under fire. She tries to protect herself. Her gun jams. What's the rest of the story? The incompetent military did not give her a weapon that worked. She didn't have what she needed to do her job. She's still looking good in this narrative. Somebody else is looking bad in this narrative now. There's another story. Now, why does the military tell us the first story? Perhaps just through innocent non-direction. People just didn't get it all right. Perhaps there's a strong desire to have the story turn out one way. Perhaps there's a disposition to believe that the country will believe one story, and if it believes the other, might take a different position. I don't know. But I know there are two different narratives there, and one was offered the American people, and the press accepted it. The public accepted it. We tend to accept narratives that are coherent. We tend to make them coherent when they're not. And possibly that's what happened. The people who reported it made it coherent where it wasn't, because they wanted it to be true. I don't know. So what the book tries to do is essentially help guide to places we've tended to find deception. And let me give you one product example to anchor it. When you see a product for a health aid, a medication or a device of some sort, and you see a frisbee thrown in the air and the dog leaps up to catch the frisbee, listen carefully to what you're being told on the screen, because when it's distracting, be wary. And if it says things like impotence and incontinence, the likelihood that the distraction level is very high on the screen is very real. If it's scary, be wary. If it's trying to distract you, be careful. We tend to pick the visual track up, not the verbal track, even though we get the verbal information and process it. So that's the first thing the book tries to do. It tries to give some simple rules to deal with it, and then it tries to put in place an understanding of the psychology literature about why it is we're so disposed to deceive ourselves and to be deceived. So that's what Unspun is about. I'm very proud of factcheck.org. I'm pleased that we've got Unspun finally finished, and I'd be happy to take any questions or comments from you. Let's start in the front and go back. Yes?
What is the answer about Halliburton and Cheney?
The claims that Edwards made were largely accurate. And so ultimately, when people got to our site, the Democrats had been very smart. They essentially knew that the question-answer structure gave Cheney such a small period of time he couldn't rebut, and he had to go someplace to rebut. I don't think they had any idea he would go to factcheck.org. I think they thought he would say that's simply untrue. But they were careful, because in that kind of exchange, the press was going to be more likely to be vigilant. Those were easy factual claims to check. The Edwards claims were things about what level of income he'd gotten while he was head of Halliburton, that sort of thing, you know, things that were not speaking to Iraq contracting, as I remember it. The best way to find out, however, is not to trust my memory, which is inexact, is likely to be shaped to be a coherent story, and is likely to be self-serving. It is to go check factcheck.org. Let's keep working back, sir.
Have any studies been done about setting the standard that should be made in a society for governments to make particular decisions?
Yeah.
For example, if you are going to set a standard that you can't make a decision until something, you have facts that determine that beyond any reasonable doubt, government will probably never react to it. On the other hand, if you're dealing with making decisions about taxes or economic reasons, mm-hmm. you might want to use a preponderance. If you're making a decision about whether you should arrest a suspected terror, you might have less than even preponderance in order to do that because that person's going to have a trial.
Yeah.
It seems to me it would be helpful if it could be outlined about which decisions should have which standards.
I'd start at one space earlier. I'd like to ask that when people offer us conclusion-based data, conclusive data, data they say is conclusive, they tell us what the standard was that they used, and they disclose the methodology so that you know how they got there. I think then the next question is, how should we determine what the standard should be? But I would have found it very helpful to have heard from Tenet when that national estimate leaked that this was the standard. And I think perhaps other people might have as well. By the way, I'm unbalanced on one side at this point, so let me give you a Kerry claim against Bush to even the ideological balance. When the Kerry ad implies that George Bush will cut current senior Social Security benefits, he is making a claim that is not supported by anything that George Bush has said. One problem with predicting to the future is you don't know what he's actually going to do. You can only say, if he's going to do it, he hasn't said he's going to do it. In fact, he said he's not going to do it. In that environment, there is a rule at play about where you're going to see deception. In politics, deception is most likely to occur in places in which you are going to be uncritical. So you make the assumption that Republicans will cut social programs. What do Democrats as a result do? They push the claim up to destroy Social Security, cut current benefits. You believe Democrats are more likely to raise taxes. What do? You push the claim up to say Kerry raised taxes, voted to raise taxes 350 times. So you start someplace that you know you already have belief, and all those psychological biases work to help the deception rather than to thwart the deception. Now I'm even, I believe. I've gotten equal numbers on the Republican-Democratic side. Yes, sir, I'm just going to keep walking back.
I'll admit that I'm subjective about reading factcheck.org. If it's against one side, I'm more likely to read it than against the other side. I don't know if this really falls into this, but the topic of transcripts, I'm very disturbed by this, and this may go back very many administrations, but with the immediacy of being able to pull transcripts online, when things are said during press conferences and they don't show up during the transcripts that are posted technically afterwards, is that something that you've studied?
There's a very brief section in the book that says, you know, that first, we've got more material transcribed than we ever have before. It's a major help. When it really matters that you know what the person said, it is very helpful to check against a good audio tape that you yourself have made. I mean, the same standard that we use elsewhere. For a lot of things that are just routine, you probably can assume that the press is following what was actually said. They were in the room, and if it grossly distorts something, somebody's going to write a story because the story is, you know, potentially newsworthy. One of the things that interests me about transcripts are the cases in which the transcript gets it wrong and nobody catches it immediately. At one point, someone transcribed, and I'm going to be paraphrasing, so this may be inexact, transcribed a Clinton State of the Union to call for meaner government. Now, you've got to ask, what's the likelihood that a president of the United States stands up and says, we want meaner government? But, you know, I would guess that the person who transcribed that wasn't ideologically sympathetic to the person who was issuing the statement, and that you probably had some of that just passing through uncritically. One of the things we've observed in Fact Check, by the way, and it becomes the kind of study that, you know, you're inclined to say to an undergraduate, wouldn't you like to do this? We get responses from people on all sides. We get a lot of mail back. It's a very interactive site. And when the fact check checks the side you don't agree with, factcheck.org is great. The best website in the country. You go. George Bush is a liar and a fool. We knew you'd come there. When it fact checks the side, the opposite side, fact check is biased. You can't trust fact check. And we are constantly getting this. Now, it's possible that we're biased on both sides all the time. I mean, you've got to worry about that. But we really do see the psychological literature coming back in our responses. And one of the reasons that Brooks and I put together the chapter on the psychological literature was so that we could just paste it back to people who are attacking us for critiquing their side. And we often invite them to send us an email the next time they see something they agree with and ask whether they've assessed the other side using an equal standard. We didn't expect that. I mean, we didn't expect people to talk to us at all, much less that they would talk to us in ways that so clearly reinforce a psychological paradigm. Yes?
Do you feel that we've lost our innate ability to spot these things? I'm a registered Republican, and Bush and Cheney, to me, are obvious BS artists. And even if you fall for their BS, how could you believe anyone who replies repeatedly that you know to reply repeatedly?
Let me start with your second point. I really try not to use the word lie, except in very, very tightly circumscribed situations. Let me tell you a circumstance in which I would use it. I would use it if I knew a president of the United States said something in public and I had good historical evidence that he knew at that time it were not true. So I know that Eisenhower knows that he's not telling the truth about the U-2 incident. I know that, because we know from the historical record that he knew. But in most cases, there's a very real possibility that the person is deceived. That is, they're engaging in self-deception, or they're engaging in any one of these psychological phenomena. And unless you're in the person's head, you don't know. And usually, with governments that are currently on the stage, we don't get the evidence that is the backdrop to know whether they knew or not. And so I reserve the word much more so than other people do. I just try not to use it.
Well, let's use deception. Does it matter whether they knew or not?
No.
What matters?
It depends on whether you want to impeach them or not. The reason for saying that misleading is an important word. It can be misleading even though you didn't intend to mislead. If you intended to mislead, then you can start worrying about how you characterize the sender. We're interested in how the audience receives the message. And if it is misleading and the audience is misled, the nice thing about having a survey is you can look at whether the audience is misled. You at least can bracket that off as discourse that should be exposed and people should be aware of before they make a voting judgment. So let me start with your second piece. The first part, the change in the capacity to deceive occurs when you can engage in rapid editing of visuals with an audio track that is different from the visual track and print on the screen that might be different from both. There's always been deception in politics. You can take it back to Cicero's time. I mean, you can take it back further than that, but I don't know those traditions. There's no reason to think that once politics was honorable and now politics is deceptive, but there are different capacities to slide things by. I'm sure the library has the broadsides from the early elections in this country in which the other side is the embodiment of evil and this side is the embodiment of good. It's just classic politics. You know, create a strong contrast between your opponent and everything that's good, and you know how the rest of that goes. What happens, however, when you move to television is you pick up a visual channel. And we have trouble engaging in what some scholars call multimodal processing, processing the audio, processing the print video, processing the video, processing the music. We know that music is a powerful cue of interpretation. It's a reason for saying, listen to that music under the wolves at, ooh, scary wolves. I do an experiment with the undergraduates periodically when they say they doubt my claim. I play the Blue Danube Waltz under a very scary ad. It actually creates an ironic frame and increases your analytic acuity. But you put all of those things together, and what you have is television's ability to edit rapidly, and that's a fairly recent phenomenon. Through the early 1960s, it just didn't have the capacity. And then throw audio in to reinforce something or distract from something else, and then put print up that may be discrepant, and then put words up orally. And now you get a phenomenon that can happen like this. Now, here the problem is I'm adding one on the Republican side, and I'm going to have to find a way to balance on the Democratic side. But this is my best example. When you've got the furlough ad the so-called revolving door, prison furlough ad. Revolving door being language does our thinking for us. You see the announcer talking about first-degree murderers, and you see a number going up on the screen as you see scary images. The number going up on the screen is not first-degree murderers who escaped. It's number of people who jumped furlough. And the ad never said first-degree murderers, this number. It said first-degree murderers, and it showed you the number. We knew reliably from test after test that audiences told you they heard that number were alleged in the ad to have escaped. They tended to do it even after we gave them a little lecture that said sometimes print is doing one thing and so be really careful. There's so much distraction there with the different channels that it's hard not to create coherence by amalgamating those two tracks. Television enhanced the capacity. I don't know that it enhanced the disposition. I don't know that it even enhanced the frequency, if we could find a way to measure frequency across time. But I think it enhanced the capacity. Yes?
Question about consequences, about misperceptions and misleading statements. I'm not sure that there are significant consequences. And the reason I raise this, you may recall there was a Cardinal football player who was killed in a crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And initially it was reported that he was killed by the enemy.
Tillman.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turned out later that that wasn't the case. And then there was some long period of time, though, when they knew that wasn't the case, they knew the military knew that wasn't the case, and never brought it out. But I'm not sure what the consequences of that are.
Yeah.
Or will be aware of that information, even the information that the first statement
Yeah. Let me talk about consequences in a little different fashion. Because there are many times in which it takes a long period of time before the country understands that it was misled. The Tonkin Gulf Resolution, you know, was put through, and we essentially licensed the Vietnam War based on evidence that does not hold up at all when we look back at it historically. And, you know, so this isn't the first time there's been deception in war. We argue in a chapter that, in fact, it's a chronic condition of war that countries tend to deceive in those times. But in that case, imagine if when the story first came out, we had instead found a way to learn what we learned later. And the narrative had been, friendly fire killed this person we can identify with because he was part of the national culture. We would have had this consequence, I assume, a discussion about the training of our soldiers to make sure that it doesn't happen again, whether or not we've got adequate intelligence relaying across these strange, difficult terrains, particularly intelligence from those things that circle in the sky. You can tell I know absolutely nothing about the technical details. And these people to try to minimize the likelihood this ever happens again. When that statement of what happened and it's incorrect gets to carry, we may not remedy a problem that we should have remedied. What should we have remedied with Jessica Lynch? At the minimum, let's make sure those guns aren't jamming on our soldiers. So, you know, you're asking the consequence question in a different way. That is, it didn't appear to make any difference. They had this long period, which everybody believed it. Well, I want to hypothesize a world in which reporters and journalists and military officers and soldiers and families and everyone asks those kinds of questions not in a way that presumes that everyone lies, but in a skeptical fashion that asks what it is we know and don't know. And I think that may have some consequence. We wrote at the end, and of course some reviewers are having fun with this, that we'd like to see a world in which we can eliminate spin. That was us spinning. I don't think it's going to happen. There is somebody over here. Yeah.
Hi. Could you say something about outright conspiracy theories? Because there's always two kinds of conspiracy theories, where the whatever the true answer is, if it's, you know, if the conspiracy theory is true, it's just this fantastic new, you know, it changes the course of history.
Yeah.
Now, a Holocaust denier, it's child's play to disprove the claim. And I had some experience with the Jonestown, Guyana catastrophe, and there were conspiracy theories associated with it, and they were all garbage. But I personally went through them and figured out what was what. And so, but on the other hand, sometimes things turn out to be true.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes you can't know. I mean, I think it's very hard for people to say, You can't know. We don't have available what we need to know what actually happened. And it's in those environments in which people create coherence, among other ways, by engaging in something that one would call a conspiracy theory unless one believed it. If one believed it, one would call it a coherent narrative that has high explanatory power. And there are genuine circumstances, I believe, in which we can't know. For whatever reason, there isn't enough there to be able to piece it together in an intelligent fashion. And I think we create coherence out of it almost viscerally, only we just don't call it conspiracy unless somebody else believes it and we doubt them. Yeah, sir.
I hesitate to raise this because it's complicated, but I want to discuss for a minute the idea that there's an objective standard of evidence of which you have to or don't have.
Yeah.
As an example, they found that by the preponderance of the evidence, Twin Towers are going to be destroyed. They didn't have it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
They remain mute, which are the evidence of action. What is the evidence based on? Based on other evidence, based on inferences, etc. And nowhere have you talked about the role, I think there is one, of intuition and judgment, and then by which these people make decisions on our behalf.
I was trying to do it, but I don't think did it well when I said there should be different standards in different circumstances, and we have to have a sense as individuals of where we're going to set the threshold. And somebody mentioned earlier, if you think there's a suspected terrorist threat, do you set a lower threshold than you do if you have a different kind of suspicion about something else? I think the most difficult thing is to ask about how we can know future fact. Because the inference to future fact doesn't let you ground anywhere except in things that you have in front of you. And, you know, what would it have taken to have raised a level of preparedness before September 11th? It would have taken people believing that the person who was trying to learn to fly an airplane but not learn how to take off and land might not be an atypical instance. And, you know, so if one says, what should one have paid attention to? That's probably something one should have paid attention to. What else should one have paid attention to? And I think that's the way one asks the question about future fact. It is to say, where is the standard in each individual case? And when you've got something as serious as massive loss of life, and I define 3,000 as mass. It's the reason for saying, I don't know what people hear when they hear mass. I hear 3,000 as mass. And I know other people don't. I know other people say a whole city is mass. But that's large, and I think cataclysmic. So, you know, what should you, any evidence that suggests there might be large-scale loss of life, indeed any loss of life, one should be very, very thorough at looking at. On the other hand, if you're trying to figure out whether somebody is innocent or guilty or not guilty, I know the lawyers are hearing that and saying, oh, no. Whether someone is guilty or not guilty, we have established thresholds in the courts. And the person who said, well, what should our thresholds be someplace else? It's a really interesting question. I think, you know, I'm very impressed by the way discourse works in the courts. I'm very impressed by the tests of evidence we've evolved over time to determine whether something should be allowed or not. I think, you know, taking just the standards that a good judge applies, that good lawyers apply, you navigate a lot of situations in politics pretty well. And then the question you ask is kind of the question of pretended. Is it a civil case or a criminal case? And you at least get some gradients of how much you're looking for in terms of a standard of evidence. For something which is highly consequential, depending on whether you're trying to prevent something from happening, in which case I would take a much lower threshold to be very, very worried, or whether you're trying to act yourself about something for you personally, such as buying a car, in which case I'd be very, very careful before I bought the car. I think we determine in real time based on our intuition about what's appropriate, based on our judgment, and we develop our judgment by making mistakes. And I think I think the academic community has done the same thing. We just don't call it that. I mean, we have standards for what constitutes publishable evidence. I mean, why do we have the confidence intervals we have in statistics? We establish a threshold by which we would say something is statistically significant. Is it, you know, 0.01? Is it 0.05? What is it? But we've got those threshold tests. But we have something else. The scholarly community has conventionalized disclosure of them. So it tells you what it knows and how it knows it inside its own methodological structure, at least in that domain. And I know that doesn't get a direct answer to your question because I don't have a direct answer to your question. But it kind of plays around the perimeter as best I can at this point. Let me go to the back.
Do you know the evolution of the use of political spin that, as you said, in America is also reflected in other countries?
One of the pernicious things about U.S. exports is that we have exported our political consultants. When people talk about where they'd like to have high visa thresholds, I'd like to have high visa thresholds before we let our political consultants go outside the country. Increasingly, other countries' politics are looking like our politics, and it's not the kind of politics we would like to see emulated. There are wonderful instances in other countries in which long-form debates were there. They were there in mass media. Our debates are a very impoverished version of debates. Our consultants get in and you see more of the kind of advertising than we have, and you have different kinds of debates with candidates having higher levels of control. So, unfortunately, one can't answer the question by saying, there's this over here and this over here, because we're over here messing up what's going on over there. And I wish we could say we're exporting some model of democracy and campaigning that was an elevated one that produced informed judgment. There was a person in the communication field who in the 1950s wrote a very important essay, I thought, in which he argued that we're exposed to a lot of discourse, and it teaches us how we should use discourse. And when you're exposed to discourse that argues poorly, that uses illegitimate forms of evidence, that engages in, you know, wild inferential leaps, that uses ad hominem, that argues from atypical examples, across time we develop a sense of what is appropriate from it, and we begin to use that as well. And I think one of the problems with what we've conventionalized in politics is we're starting to create, as an exemplary model for discourse, something that is not exemplary. It is nonetheless effective, and that's problematic. If we're not exemplary and ineffective, we wouldn't worry about it. It's extremely effective. Let's go back here.
I really dislike negative campaign ads. Mm-hmm. And I've been watching the Philadelphia general election. They don't seem to have been quite as negative, but they're actually stating certain positives.
Yeah.
It seems to be sort of been missing in national elections. Do you think this might be a trend?
Now, let me first address the use of the word negative. I've tried unsuccessfully for my entire academic career to get that word out of the vocabulary of reporters. The reason I don't like the word is that it conflates two very different things. It conflates legitimate attack with illegitimate attack. And you don't want to take attack out of politics. Legitimate attack differentiates between candidates. It tells you how they differ on issue positions, and when it is fair and accurate. And addressing governance is extremely helpful. It's not helpful when that's all you do, because then you have no reason to vote for somebody. You just know why you want to vote against. If both sides are telling you why to vote against, you're being told not to vote. There's no viable alternative. So if you're asking about the level of attack, yes, I think the mayoral race here has a higher level of advocacy than one ordinarily would have expected in a Philadelphia mayoral race. That is not setting a high standard. But there has been across time an increasing proportion of attack in most races. And so when you get a slightly smaller level, that's noteworthy. But notice, if it's legitimate attack, I don't find it problematic, as long as there's advocacy to tell you why to vote for something. Someone, advocacy is what ties campaigning to governance. Attack doesn't. And we need to tie campaigning to governance, or there isn't really any reason to vote. You're voting in order to try to get a certain point of view or a certain philosophy or a certain individual elected in order to represent something. And we can't simply do that by high levels of attack on all sides. We actually see high levels of attack as a strategy to demobilize voters. When you want to make sure that your opponent's natural base doesn't vote in high proportion, because you know if that base votes in high proportion in that geographical location, you're going to lose. The strategy of choice is push your level of attack up, bait the opponent into counterattacking, and in the process try to demobilize the electorate. And that's when I start worrying about even legitimate attack at very high levels. Let's see, I'll make sure I don't miss anything before coming back. Back of the room. Yes, ma'am.
A lot of what you are speaking about refers to a passive commentary and analysis of what is out there, what is fun out there. How often do you go on the aggressive and assert what is wrong in our discourse? Do you do that? Does your organization do that?
I hope that you would.
Yeah, I do that in books. But if, when you're given television time, and you know, I get a little window of television time every 4 years. And I know when I've hit the window because people stop me in the train station. And you, they say, you know, you look familiar. And then they say things like, you know, do you work at the Marriott? Or so you know you have a small window. But that small window isn't open for pronouncements about what discourse should be unless you're on Bill Moyers' show. And periodically I will sneak that in when I'm talking to Bill Moyers. And I'm going to try to sneak it in next week. Bill Moyers on Friday, 9 o'clock in this media market. New show, Bill Moyers Journal. But you know, when you're doing commentary on the NewsHour, for example, they have a specific news objective. Their objective is to have their audience make sense of competing claims in ads. And so you can only indirectly say, now the reason that this is problematic is that, that essentially doesn't do X, Y, and Z. I wrote a chapter in the book called Dirty Politics that said that we should try in discourse for argument, engagement, and accountability in our discourse. We should try for a kind of discourse that increases the likelihood that audiences use discourse that opens them to alternatives and intelligently assesses them before making decisions. We ought to increase the likelihood that the end of rhetoric is judgment, not compliance, not uncritical assent. And you know, in capsule, if I were to try to lay that out, that's what I would say. I tried it again in the chapter of Everything You Think You Know About Politics and Why You're Wrong, because I didn't think I'd gotten it right the first time, and added a few other nuances, largely about how you get to something called judgment. I mean, Aristotle had a great notion when he said the end of rhetoric is judgment. It isn't spectatorship. It isn't, you know, non-critical assent. It's judgment. It's a process by which you weigh, you analyze, and you offer an affirmative assent to something. And some discourse invites it, and some doesn't. And much of what we talk about in the book doesn't. It deflects you from it. It tries to get your consent in ways that you wouldn't yield it. Yield may be the wrong word if you're engaging in judgment. My time is up, but I'll stay as long as anybody would like to talk to me. Thank you very much for coming. And again, thank you to the Bodek family.
And don't forget that copies of Unspun are available at the back of the room. Thank you all for coming.